How do we tell stories that engage, inspire, and have a lasting impact? How do we turn thoughts and ideas into effective and authentic storytelling? How can we use stories to make a difference in our work, lives, and communities? I'm your host, Camille DePutter, and together we'll explore what it means to tell stories with heart. Welcome to another episode of the Storytelling with Heart podcast. I'm your host, Camille DePutter, and today I'm excited to introduce someone who I have closely collaborated with for years, Dr. Krista Scott Dixon. Krista Scott Dixon is an expert coach, communicator, and thought leader in the fitness and health industry. She has more than 20 years in fitness and health coaching under her belt and 10 years of university teaching and course direction. Krista is currently the product director at Simple, a nutrition app with global reach. Previously, she served as director of curriculum at Precision Nutrition, leading the development of the PN Academy and PN certifications. She is the author of several books and co-author of textbooks, many of which we've worked on together. Plus, she has an extensive portfolio of academic publications, book chapters, articles, reports, you name it, not to mention her own self-published book, Why Me Want Eat. Before working with Precision Nutrition, Dr. Scott Dixon was a researcher and faculty member at York University in Toronto. In the mid-90s, her website, stumptuous.com, was one of the first to promote women's weight training, and since then, she's focused on helping people make meaningful change. Through all her communications, Krista is known for being compassionate, down-to-earth, pragmatic, and funny, and that's a big reason why I wanted to have her on the show today to explore how we can communicate ideas, including technical, scientific, and complex materials with humanity and personal style. Welcome, Krista.
Thank you for having me. I will admit I feel a little anxious now that the word funny has been uttered because it's just like, oh God, the pressure's on.
Yeah, that's it kind of sets you up. Didn't know that you were like here to do a stand-up routine.
That's like or you know, like read a poem or something.
Yeah, although it is true. Like, do you recognize that about yourself?
Oh yeah, no, I'm ridiculous. Like, absolutely. And I really hope that on my tombstone, it'll just have one word and that word is fun. But it does feel like a little intimidating when someone introduces you that way and you're like, oh God. And actually, I am the world's worst joke teller, like in terms of like a structured joke. I am truly the worst. I have none in my arsenal. So if anyone ever asked me, like in a job interview, tell a joke. And yeah, it's so I have to rely on one-liners and just random stupid stuff.
I mean, you know, I appreciate that though. And I think it kind of actually tees up well some of the things we can potentially explore in this chat, because that idea that it needs to be formal, right? That like humor is joke telling or even a refined skill as opposed to say, the freedom to be yourself, to let your goofiness and kind of weirdness and like freak flag come out, is also some, like, I think often there are a bit of these gaps in understanding between what effective communication can look like, including humor and personality. And that doesn't mean it needs to be super formal, actually maybe quite the opposite.
Yeah. I actually think I am allergic to formality. I fail formality in almost every context. And so it's not that I'm inappropriate, but I can generally be counted on to be somehow irreverent or, you know, skewering ceremony in some way or another. And I definitely have learned throughout my life that one of the environments in which I do not thrive is an environment that relies really heavily on formality, on hierarchy, on structure, on you know, like I would probably die within the British royal family, for example. I'd be like, why are we doing this? This is ridiculous. So, and I guess that's a good thing to know. But, you know, to go back to what funny means, and I don't know if we want to unpack this or not, but really to me, it's like an attitude of irreverence and being able to see that so much of what we do is really just kind of a cosmic joke. And obviously, you know, we want to play on the full keyboard, right? We want to be able to appreciate the whole spectrum of life from the darkest elements to the most euphoric. But I think that, you know, it behooves us, if I can say it that way, to appreciate that really nothing is terribly serious if you look at it. And I think it was Charlie Chaplin that said something like, life is a tragedy in close up, but it's a comedy in long shot. And when you kind of stand back and look at the big picture, you know, like a lot of what we do and think and worry about, especially in the day to day, especially at the granular level, is funny. Like we're all here hamstering and worrying and thinking about stuff. And then if you stand back, you're like, that's actually kind of, it's all silly. It starts to seem kind of silly, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have that? So that natural understanding of yourself, being someone who does not want to be put in a box or too tight of a framework, were you always that way? Is that how you were as a kid too?
I'm laughing because I think that was pretty much like right out of the womb, 100%. I was, you know, even as a little kid, that was me completely. And I was raised by, now my dad was a funny guy, but my mom was pretty straight-laced. And I actually always wondered how they got together because my mom had a very minimal sense of humor. And I always wondered, like, how did she just like tolerated my dad for decades? Yeah, like it's always been that way as far back as I can remember. And my parents, I'm sure if they were alive, would tell stories about like stupid stuff that I did or said, or just, you know, could not be trained in any way to take things seriously.
Mm-hmm. And yet you got your PhD and went into academia at first, which it can be kind of rigid and formulaic.
Yeah. And that's why I left because, you know, I think over the last few decades, so I left in 2007, and at that time, it was seen as a little bit shocking. And I think now, as we're recording this in 2024, I think that's seen much more as a viable path that you could, you know, be in academia and then you could explore the world outside of academia. And definitely that was one of the big contributors in academia. I just like, I don't want to play this game of structure and systems and hierarchy and basically working with a system with quasi feudal roots and in some ways it's like actively psychotic, right? So now I was lucky because I did a discipline that was a little bit more loose. It was a little bit more edgy, a little bit more a little bit more radical, but I did try to go back into academia. So when I finished my PhD, so then, you know, maybe, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I thought, well, maybe I'll go back and do a master's in counseling psychology. Cause you know, it's useful for coaching. And I didn't last 6 months in academia. I was now way too undomesticated. You know, I was in there. I was like, why are we, you know, like I failed an essay because I didn't write it in the right font. And I was just like, oh my God, like, is this the game that we're playing? And so I think that if, you know, a lot of people are chafing against the structures of academia, and I was definitely one of them. But the good news is there's way more on the outside. So mm-hmm. There was lots of opportunities for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm. What about on the communication side? Like as a kid, did you love to write? Did you like to speak? Did you mind being did you like to be in the spotlight or behind the scenes? Like what were you like in that sense?
Written and verbal language skills, like right out of the gate, were always high, right? Like I taught myself to read when I was 2 or 3. My mom gave me these phonics records. Like I had a little record player and my mom gave me these phonics records and just left me alone with them because that was the 70s. And, you know, you didn't actively parent in the 70s. We were all just kind of cactuses. So yeah, like I would sit there with my little records and learn phonics. And apparently I was reading by 2 or 3. And that was that. But in terms of speaking, like as a kid, I was horribly shy. Like I couldn't make eye contact. The idea of talking to an adult was horrifying to me. Even now, sometimes I'm like, oh, I have to call the dentist. Oh God, it's an adult, right? but no, I definitely did not like to speak. Now I love it. It's something I really enjoy doing. It feels very natural for me. But definitely as a kid, it was not like I would certainly call myself an introvert. I was not one of those, like, you know, you see little kids that are just going to be natural extroverts. Like they're walking down the street and they're 2 years old and everyone that's walking past, they're like, hi, that was not me. I was hiding under the chair.
No, me too. I mean, I'm familiar with the kinds of kids you're describing. It was not my personal experience either.
Yeah, they're. It is funny how you can see personality starting so young, right? And you meet those little kids, and you're like, you're going to go into sales later in life. You know, the kids that come right up to you and they're like, all right, will you be my friend? Can we talk? Can we hang out? Like, yeah. Get away from me.
But I, one thing that you, that I feel comes very strongly through all of your work. And I think this, if people are familiar with your work, your writing and teaching, I think they will already know this about you. But if not, it might sound kind of even surprising, considering that a lot of the material that you've been involved in and that we've worked on together has been educational. It's been certification textbooks and materials that are meant to, you know, help coaches coach better or help people, you know, learn and practice health habits and things like that. But I feel that your approach to writing, and this would go for speaking and kind of educating as well, is like really grounded in a connection with the other person, with, I think, empathy and a desire to actually kind of meet and connect with the person on the other side of that material. What are your thoughts on that? And like, is that deliberate? Does that come from your kind of your natural empathy? And, you know, how, as much as we kind of joke about being introverts or whatever, that like, you're naturally interested in caring in the other person? Or is that something that you've cultivated? I'm just curious about kind of your overall response to that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's both. And I think, you know, we have this idea that either you have natural abilities or you don't. And obviously there's a spectrum. I mean, we just talked about kids that are naturally more sociable, right? Mm-hmm. There's obviously a spectrum of whatever you get factory installed, let's call it. But there's also a huge role for whatever you cultivate. So obviously I was not born a psychopath. I have the ability to empathize with others. And I think that's a big misconception about introverts, actually, that we hate people somehow. Now, some days we do hate people. I think we all hate people more after the pandemic. But, you know, I think that a lot of introverts are actually quite deeply interested in people. And so they don't favor the let's go to a big concert with 50,000 other people. What they really like is, can I sit down with someone and just talk one-on-one and really engage in a deep way that's not superficial? So for us, that's often very like enjoyable and nourishing. So first of all, I do think that there's, you know, there is such a thing as a sociable introvert or an introvert that really likes and appreciates and is interested in people. So that's me. And I've always had a curiosity about people, but a feeling for people, but my ability to be empathetic now, especially in my role as a coach, is like 80% cultivated, I would say. You know, it's a skill that I have refined and built and practiced and thought about. And sometimes it's conscious, right? Sometimes if I'm working in my job, for instance, developing an app, I sit down and I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, okay, like, how would I be experiencing this? Like, for example, I just did it thinking about how people would experience our app if they were older, right? Because, for example, you know, your eyes start to go, right? And you're like, why is this? Why are these letters so small, right? Like, all of a sudden, everything starts to get small. And you're like, why? So even stuff like, you know, how would someone with not amazing dexterity navigate an app screen? What would they see visually? Would there be enough color contrast? Would the font size be large enough? And so it can be a very conscious practice, and then it can be just an intuitive unconscious practice, right? You have a feeling for people, you have a feeling for situations. So I think it's all of the above. And I think that whatever gifts that anyone has can be cultivated if you want, and you can build them to a fairly high level of sophistication with practice, with repetition. But if you are writing for an audience, I think that empathy is a non-negotiable. Like, you have to, and there's different kinds of empathy, right? There's thought empathy, which actually sociopaths and psychopaths are quite good at, which is recognizing how other people think, right? Being able to take their perspective and how they look at the world. But then there's also emotional empathy. Am I feeling what you're feeling right now? Am I vibing with you? Am I able to read your emotional cues and intuit what you are feeling and feel with you? So there's kind of different shades of empathy. And I think sometimes it gets bundled into this like catch-all term that is actually not well-defined. So then people are like, I don't really feel other people's feels, like, does that mean I'm unempathetic? Maybe not, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And I think it tends to go as well, sometimes kind of along with compassion, which is another term that is kind of vague and is maybe a bit of a buzzword in a way. You know, it's used quite a bit, and people may or may not particularly relate to it. But I feel like in your work as well, there's a lot of not just empathy, but compassion, like trying to look at things through a compassionate lens, whether that's teaching people how to coach better or teaching people how to make change in their lives. Like, can you talk to me a little bit about compassion?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you're right. Compassion has been a bit of a buzzword, and I think it's often poorly defined. And I think sometimes people worry, like, okay, is compassion just accepting and liking whatever happens? Like, oh, that's fine. It's no big deal. No. Is compassion letting people off the hook and not holding people accountable? No. I would actually argue that compassion requires honesty. Like, you have to be able to see a situation realistically as it is in order to be able to fully apprehend and acknowledge someone's suffering and struggle. So to me, compassion has a few pieces, right? One of them is about acknowledging our common humanity, right? Like, all of us are in the mess together. All of us suffer. All of us struggle. All of us have hard times. So just kind of acknowledging that that's part of the human condition is one. Another piece of it is something that I would call befriending, right? Or kindness. It's, you know, experiencing someone who is struggling and suffering and choosing to offer kindness, to offer grace, to offer care in that moment. And it's, I think, a genuine desire to alleviate that suffering for people. So those are kind of like three components. And I know that compassion researchers have, like, you know, broken it down into really granular mm-hmm. concepts, but those are sort of distinct for me, right? I can acknowledge your struggles, for example, without wanting to make them better. So I think that, you know, compassion is really like a hopefulness in a way. And often there's tons of situations that you can't fix, especially in coaching or just in life in general. People die, people get hurt, people get sick, you know, shit happens, right? So compassion is also kind of about your ability to be with what is in a way that hopes for things or hopes for some kind of ease. You know, I hope that things will be easy for you. I see you struggling. There's no way for you to unstruggle here. My best hope for you is like kind of an ease or a relief, maybe, right? So I think it also requires like this ability to be totally realistic. And like I said, it can definitely go along with accountability. You know, like, I can have compassion for your struggling and still hold you to account and be like, okay, look, I know you're having a bad day, right? But you still have to show up in this way. So I think that's just a common misconception. And I want to kind of like skewer, especially when it comes to self-compassion. You know, a lot of people will say, well, if I don't criticize myself, then I won't know how to motivate myself. I won't be pushed to achieve things. And of course, the research is quite the opposite, right? Self-criticism is the parking brake on your performance. It's guaranteed to make you suck, pretty much, versus self-compassion, which, as we're beginning to realize, even in high-performance occupations, you know, before we got on this call, I was telling you about one of my clients who's in the military. Like, I'm teaching people now who are going through elite military selection to have self-compassion, which sounds crazy. It's like, what? But it's this really interesting paradox. When we give ourselves grace for our struggles and befriend ourselves, it just frees up so much mental and emotional real estate for us to get on with the job at hand versus self-criticism, where we're just like, that's all our brain can work on right now. So it's almost like it jams the gears. So there's probably a lot to unpack here. I don't know if we want to go in this direction, but that's my take on it.
I'm curious as to like how that came up for you in your life and work to be such a cornerstone. Because I feel like that is it's an important part of the way that you coach and teach and also write and communicate. So was that something, again, that you learned and realized over time? Was it something that played a role in your own life? How did that transpire for you?
Yeah, great question. That is definitely something I've always had. Like, I remember, you know, being a kid and letting myself get beat up because I did not want to hurt other people. I have a very clear memory of like this one scenario where I just like allowed myself to get the crap kicked out of me because I didn't want to hurt anybody. Now I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
and lay waste a little bit, but that's definitely an impulse I can certainly remember feeling. And that was one of my frustrations with academia, because I was like, we are not helping people. Like, I felt, rightly or wrongly, that one of my roles in academia was to be of service, was to help people, you know, in any kind of way. There's lots of ways we can help people. But I was like, if I'm not helping and serving people or making their lives better or making the world better, then I'm useless. Like, what am I doing here? Right. So that's definitely been an ongoing theme. I think for me, the real revelation that really started like firing on all cylinders was self-compassion. That is like, that's where really things started to get going. And I didn't really develop that until maybe my mid-30s, when I was competing in jiu-jitsu and struggling with losing, you know, I mean, just the natural struggles of competing in anything athletically. And I was like, oh, this sucks. I feel so bad. And so I started reading up on sports psychology, and that's kind of where it started. I was like, oh, self-compassion is a thing that makes us better. Okay, cool. So that was something I definitely had to learn, definitely had to practice. I think I'm pretty good at it now, but you know, there's always room for improvement. But compassion for others is like super easy for me. But importantly, I think there are also boundaries on that, right? And I think that, you know, a lot of people struggle with over empathizing with others, with over compassioning, if I can say that that way, without clear boundaries. Because I think that, you know, we get the idea, especially, you know, depending on how you were raised, if you were always raised to manage the feelings of everybody else in your household, you didn't have that balance of like, okay, I need to take care of me so that I can take care of you. So I think, you know, one of the other key pieces to mention here is that it's also really important to have good boundaries and knowing how to manage your capacity for compassion, because what we've definitely seen in this pandemic era, I mean, it happened beforehand, but I think the pandemic just like amplified it, is so many people in service roles, teachers, nurses, health, you know, other healthcare workers, first responders, just being exhausted by the level of demand on their compassion without any support, without any ability to refill that cup of compassion. So, you know, compassion fatigue is a thing too. So this is all kind of a long, you know, extended way of saying this has been a real learning process for me. So it's, I think a lot of people have the natural equipment to be compassionate, but then like any superpower, you have to learn how to manage your gift and keep it safe and be a good steward of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like going back to that story about being a kid and being bullied or being even beaten up and not defending yourself.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's not really what we want either.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We want balance. We want balance in the force, right? We want boundaries. And the more you have good, and this is kind of a paradox, the more you have good boundaries, healthy boundaries and very intentional boundaries, the better able you are to give compassion and to give empathy when it's warranted. Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned competing, and that actually jogged my memory on something else that I wanted to ask you, which was a bit about your involvement in getting involved in strength training and getting involved in health and fitness and starting your blog, Stumptuous. Can you kind of tell us the story of how that blog came to be, what was going on in your life at the time and where that took you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was never an athletic kid. I mean, I was always the kid picked last for teams. I was small and I had glasses and I had braces and, you know, like it was just, I had so many moments in my life of just like, as the teams were getting picked, just knowing I was going to be the last one. Right. But in grade 9, so this would have been 1985, I guess, 85, 86, you know, as part of the obligatory grade 9 gym class, it was like a girls gym class. I don't know. It was mostly aerobics or whatever, but the gym teacher took us into the weight room And I remember walking in and there were two older girls talking about female bodybuilders. And I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. That's what I want. Right. And that was kind of the heyday of women's bodybuilding. Like when it actually kind of took off for several years and it got really big, I guess, relatively speaking, not, you know, super big, but it was kind of the pre-steroid era. Right. So like the women's bodies were very approachable in a sense. It was like, oh, if I work out, I could look like that realistically. Right. And so this kind of sparked my imagination. I took another weightlifting course in high school. And I sort of did it off and on through university, but in grad school, you know, so early to mid 90s, as anyone who's been in grad school will know, it's not the most health promoting lifestyle. Right? So I think I gained about 50 pounds and I was like, oh my God, I feel not so good. My eating habits are terrible. I got to get on top of this, but I'm not good at any sports. You know, I can't run. I didn't, you know, and I was a broke student. I was like, I don't know what to do. So I was like, okay, the only thing I'm pretty sure that I can do is lift weights. Like it doesn't involve catching a ball or anything like that. I can just go and I can go early in the morning so nobody sees me, right? So I can just be off in the corner doing my thing. And that's how it got started. But, you know, and I heard so many women. And so that was like the era of Shape magazine and women were getting told like, you should never lift anything more than 3 pounds or 5 pounds because, you know, you'll wake up humongous. And I was like, okay, women carry babies in their uterus, right? And then they carry toddlers in their arms. Like that's a ridiculous concept. So I knew it was wrong. And at the time I was at a university and I had access to a university library and I was like, okay, I cannot be the only woman who thinks this advice is crap, but I need to be able to share it in a way that's informed. So I think it was 97 I started my website because I was, you know, very active in online forums about lifting weights and that kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, if I write some Q&As, some little articles for other women and just put them on the internet, maybe some other women will find them helpful. So that's how it started. Just wanting to, again, wanting to help, wanting to be of service, empathizing with other women's frustrations wherever they were in the world. And then it grew into a website and I had so many people, you know, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, like just messaging me like, thank you so much. It was so hard to find good information. So it really became kind of a thing. And I think it also spoke to women who, like me, did not really have a background in sports, did not necessarily feel comfortable, did not identify as athletes. For some reason, I sort of tapped into the zeitgeist of all of these women who were looking for something to feel good in their bodies, but did not, were not able to access it through kind of more, let's say, traditional ways. So yeah, it became a really interesting sort of niche, kind of an alt, you know, an alternative space for a while. Now it's incredibly mainstream, and it's I almost feel like I'm a victim of my own advocacy because, you know, recently going into commercial gyms, I'm like, oh my God, now I can't get a squat cage. People are, you know, like young women are deadlifting, they're squatting, they're lifting heavy, they're power cleaning, they're doing Olympic lifts. And I'm like, damn it. Like I can't even get a bar anymore. So it used to be the platform. There'd be nobody on a platform or in a squat cage, but now it's like, oh my God, like there's some 82 pound, you know, tiny UBC student who's lifting like 3 times her body weight. I feel like I've created a monster here. So it's both wonderful, but also slightly aggravating. But yeah, that's how it all got started.
Like when I hear that story and when I think about that, you know, it's interesting because it was at a different time. The amount of sheer content, particularly in the health and fitness space in North America, but on just about anything you could imagine too, there's just so much information out there. There's so much content. And yet, so I just want to acknowledge you were doing that in a different time when, you know, you were an outlier and also there was less available. So to write a blog and a good blog that would resonate with people and make a difference was sort of more, it was more possible to maybe stand out. But like, I also think about the fact that from you exploring that interest, sharing it, wanting to be of service, maybe going the extra mile to do some research around it and actually kind of put stuff together in a way that people could read and connect to, it helped you build your career and your thought leadership, if we can use that term, and kind of the the brand in a way that you've built for yourself. Like to me, and when I think of your story, it kind of starts there. And if you didn't do that, things, you know, may have gone in a different direction. Like how do you contextualize that to you? Do you have a similar takeaway to me in that making that effort to create that thing and to share your thoughts was an important and valuable moment or milestone in your own development?
I think so. I mean, I think that's been a persistent theme through my whole career, really. And I think it's a way to explore the world of work and a career or a craft or however you want to think about it in a way that's very joyful and engaging and curiosity-based. Because I think that some of the zeitgeist around work now, and like there's lots of layers to this, but I think a lot of people think about work like, okay, well, I have some formal training and I will go and look for a place that is willing to hire me to do this set of things that I know how to do, right? And to me, that's very backwards, because if you are at all innovative and creative and interested in growth, you will never find a job that is perfect for you with using that model, because what you want to do doesn't exist yet. Right? There's not like a puzzle piece slot waiting for you to slot your puzzle piece into. It doesn't work like that. So in a way, it's like you're always creating your own path and your own career based on the things that you find engaging or that spark your curiosity or the things that are burning in you to share with other people or, you know, whatever it is. So, and I want to be careful here because I know that the opposite advice of like, follow your passion is also not super helpful, right? I think what we're talking about here is there are going to be things for you that are sparky for you, right? They spark something in you. They speak to something. You can't even explain why they do, but you just know that you're obsessed with this thing, or you're just really interested and you find yourself wanting to learn more about it. The other piece of that though, is that then in the process of chasing that rabbit down the hole, you have to build the skills to execute on that. It's like, oh, I really love playing the harmonica, but I never practice. Okay, then you're just going to, you know, then you're just going to be like, hee, hee, hee. Like no one wants to listen to it, right? So you have to both have an interest and a curiosity for the things that engage you, and then devote yourself to the discipline of building the skills that allow you to put that out in the world, right? So I've had, you know, people are saying to me now, like, oh, you write really well. I'm like, yeah, I'm 50 years old. I have been working on this with deliberate feedback, all kinds of feedback, a lot of it pretty harsh, right? But I collaborate with peers. I collaborate with people who give me feedback. I had all manner of editors and whoever, you know, through my whole career that shot me straight on like whether something was good or not. I've been doing this for like 30 years, right? So yeah, of course. Like I think it would be remarkable if I wasn't any good at this. but I think that's the piece that people miss, is that to execute whatever it is you want to execute requires the dedication and the discipline. And I mean, discipline in a productive sense, like practicing an instrument, to really stand out in the field and be able to do what you want to do. So there's sort of two halves of that equation. But if you're waiting around for someone to say, oh my God, you're so smart, you're so awesome, come and do this job that you love doing, it doesn't exist. It's not going to happen. You're always bringing what you want to do into being, and kind of selling other people on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's such an accurate, summary of kind of like what it takes and the opportunity that exists. Cause I'm a big fan, obviously, of encouraging people to make things, create things, whether that is your own kind of job for yourself, as you alluded to, or whether it is a book or kind of just carving out your own little piece of the world where you can make your thing and create something and put your thoughts out there. And you kind of mentioned like the skills and the skills maybe around the communicating or the making of the thing, the expression of it, like, you know, the skill to play the instrument. But I think also a part of that you've also spent many years doing has been the kind of rigor around not just the writing and the expression, but the ideas themselves. It seems to me that the kinds of things, the spaces that you occupy, where you tend to write and work, are also around issues and topics and ideas where you have spent a lot of time practicing building skills and developing your knowledge, your wisdom on those subjects. So I kind of it's like the doing, but also the, I don't know, the, I don't know what you would call that, but like the other kind of thinking and rigor behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The long-term marination and testing and iteration. And certainly, for example, in the field of coaching, I mean, when I first started coaching, like it was embarrassing how wrong I was about so many things, about how to do it, about what people really wanted, what they were really looking for. And I think there has to be a willingness to test your ideas, experiment, like run experiments on them and see it, put them out, see if they work, and then be fully willing to refine them, discard them in the face of whatever evidence emerges. And good ideas take time. Like, I think we have this idea in Western culture of like good ideas happen when you sit around and like think really deeply, and then an idea pops and you're like, oh, eureka, I've got it, right? We have this great man, and I use that term deliberately, capital G, capital M, theory of how ideas happen. And it's always like there's one guy working in his genius lab in genius ways, sitting around thinking deeply, and all of a sudden, boop, it pops, right? Well, it doesn't work like that at all. First of all of these guys had teams of people that they collaborated with, and their ideas were built on a vast array of unacknowledged intellectual contributions. Like, for example, a lot of people talk about Maslow's hierarchy, right? The hierarchy of needs and how self-actualization is at the top. Well, Maslow spent a significant amount of time with indigenous groups absorbing, and I don't know, it's debatable whether he appropriated it or not, their worldview, and like took that intellectual framework and turned it into something, in a certain way that sort of diverged from the original model. But like, that was informed by his time with these people, right? But if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, what's called Maslow's hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. He named it after himself. So, you know, you might think, oh, this guy just sat around, drew a triangle, and came up with this, right? It doesn't work like that at all. And so great ideas take time, they take refinement and self-challenge, but they also take a ton of collaboration. And there are so many just like unacknowledged contributions to our own ideas. Like, you know, you're walking down the street and you see something and you're like, oh, you see a cat, you know, and you're like, oh, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, a cat is in the box and maybe it's either there or not there. And boom, you have Schrodinger's cat. Pretty sure that's not how
but
it happened.
The cat never got any credit. That cat's still waiting around to all be I'm credited. Saying is, that's right. Like, Mr. Mistopheles is sitting at home waiting for his credit.
That's right. Exactly. You know, so ideas can be sparked by so many things, but I think that we really do not acknowledge the base of the iceberg that, you know, is required for these ideas to emerge, and the huge amount of collaboration that occurs. And so I think what happens then, people think about ideas this way. They're like, okay, I got to sit down and have a good idea, right? So they cloister themselves away and they get their pen ready and they click, 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 you know, okay, I'm going to have a good idea. It never works like that. To have good ideas, to sort of refine your own ideas, you have to be out in the world having experiences. And, you know, one of the particular challenges of the health and fitness industry that I work in is that it tends to be quite insular, right? So other, you know, health and fitness people talk to other health and fitness people about health and fitness things. And then what tends to happen is you lose perspective about what is going on in the world and what people care about. So then you become that personal trainer that's telling your client, no excuses, right? Beyonce has the same number of hours in her day. So I don't see why you, as a working parent of four children, can't find time to meal prep. Like, it's just a ludicrous conversation, right? Because they've lost perspective of how, quote unquote, regular people live. So it's also incredibly important to get out in the world and have a diverse array of experiences, especially experiences that challenge you or that are not familiar to you. You know, like there's that proverbial, like, take you out of your comfort zone, but like deliberately go and seek experiences that truly challenge you at the soul level. And that's where ideas come from as well.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's such a, it's very sound advice. And I mean, I love that because too, I kind of grew up collaborating. And when I went to school, I did an HBA with two majors, and one of them was English and the other was a program that's no longer offered by U of T anymore, but it was equity studies, which was an international or an interdisciplinary program. So you took classes in poli-sci and indigenous studies and like all different kinds of, you know, disability studies and some more niche ones as well. But so, you know, it's very different taking like a women's studies class and then like maybe a more standard philosophy class or poli-sci class or something like that. So you're getting like different kinds of people and methods and ways of looking at a set of problems or questions that kind of revolved around social justice, but through the lens of working kind of in different ways, as opposed to being in just like one little space with the same group of people. And I found that immensely valuable. That also influenced how I tend to look at things and kind of wanting to source out different ideas, different viewpoints, different ways of living and working, because I agree, when we're very insular, I mean, it's wonderful to really get to know in a deep way your audience, your subject matter, the people that you want to serve and the space that you want to work in. But I think it really actually can be quite limiting if we're not just out there mixing it up, kind of as you described.
Yeah. And as you were talking, I was like, and then on top of the women's studies and philosophy classes, go and work in retail, go and volunteer at an animal shelter, go and take a carpentry class, right? Like really think extremely broadly about the kinds of it. Go to a country where not only do you not speak the language, you can't even recognize the alphabet, right? Just put yourself in situations that are very destabilizing to yourself in all kinds of ways. And one of the things that made me want to leave academia was I started getting involved with kind of at-risk, you know, like unhoused, refugee, you know, street active people in the trans community in Toronto in the early 2000s, late 1990s and early 2000s. And I remember like sitting there, you know, talking to people and like they would tell me their stories and I'd be like, what you're telling me has nothing to do with what I'm learning. And that's the fault of what I'm learning. It's not the fault of your lived experience. Like there was such a huge disconnect between, you know, people's lived experiences that were much different from mine that they were having in real time and what I was learning about like how this all works. And so it's also really important that you, when you absorb ideas, you have to go out in the world and test them. And I think that, you know, philosophy is a great example. So many of these break down because you start to realize, wait a minute, these were produced by people. I have this theory, which is that I now no longer particularly trust the ideas of people who do not scrub their own toilets, right? And so you have all these people that have come up with great ideas and I'm looking at them, I'm like, you clearly have never done, you've never worked retail, you've never worked minimum wage, you've never done housework, you've never done, you know, elder care. Like there's just so many experiences of life that you've never had. So frankly, thanks for your advice, but it's not going to be super useful for me, right? So I think we have to test all of these ideas, even stuff like, and I know this is sort of a thing in like the productivity community, like morning routines, right? You need to have a morning routine. And then you have all these guys who are like, oh, well, you know, I wake up and then I do a cold plunge and then I drink some green tea and then I meditate and then I journal. And I'm reading this and I'm like, again, try to imagine that working parent, you know, with four kids, like their morning routine is like, I get woken up by a child who's like, mommy, I made a puke in the bed, right? And you're like, oh God. Then you get up and there's email and you're like, you know, that's your morning routine, right? Mm-hmm. It's just so disconnected from these idealized worlds. So I think we need to be very careful about testing the source of any ideas that we are absorbing and really ask questions. Not that we expect people to live any kind of life of perfection. That's not what I'm saying. But it's like, is this person in touch with reality? That's the starting place for me. Is this person in touch with reality as it is lived by the vast majority of people on this planet? Because if they're not, I'm going to be very critical. I'm not saying you can't have a good idea. I'm just saying that your idea is going to get a lot more scrutiny from me than if it's someone who like I can look at and be like, yes, you really do represent mm-hmm. like the lived reality, the global lived reality of people on this planet. Mm-hmm. That's maybe I'm gonna bump your idea up the hierarchy a little bit.
I love it. You've had a lot of experiences at this point. And how do you do that today? Like, how do you put yourself in situations these days to challenge yourself or evolve your thinking or continue that kind of practice that you're describing?
I think it's been different since the pandemic, only because I think, you know, for a lot of us, it really affected things like mobility. I mean, like, yeah, we're still traveling and whatever, but I think it's changed some of the decisions that we make about the risks we take or the situations we put ourselves in. But that being said, you know, I've definitely challenged myself intellectually to go into spaces of practice where I have no idea what's going on, right? So working in product development, I'm not a product developer. I have no background in, you know, in making apps. I'm not a software engineer, right? And so like working with this organization that I'm working with, when I first started, it was primarily Russian speakers, most of whom were like highly technical people. Like they were analysts, they were software people. Like I knew of coaching and I knew health and fitness, but I didn't know what I was doing when I put myself there. I didn't like, you know, I was like, okay, I guess I'm gonna learn how to speak Russian. Like literally my first day on the job, like, you know, the HR person was like, okay, here's your Google Mail setup. And I opened it. It was all in Russian. I was like, oh my God, I have to somehow figure out how to get into my Gmail and like change my language. Like that was my first day on the job. Right. And so every day on this job and then in other roles I've taken on in my coaching, I have deliberately sought out places where I don't know what the heck is going on. Right. Mm-hmm. Whether that's working on, well, I mean, even things like, you know, working in AI, I don't have a background in AI. All of a sudden I find myself on projects where it's like, what should we do with AI? Right. And I have to get up to speed really quickly. I don't have a background in the military. All of a sudden I'm working with military clients. I'm like, okay, I guess I'm going to get up to speed with that. I guess I'm going to learn Russian. Literally after this call, I have a Russian lesson. So a lot of the risks have been placing myself into situations where I really have no background in what I'm doing. And not that I speak from a place of expertise. It's not like I walk in and I'm like, I'm the boss and I know what I'm doing. But putting myself in the room where there are things going on that I don't know about and just kind of letting that wash over me, identifying the places where I can work, where I have an opportunity to do something that I know how to do or where I can grow into, you know, where it's just adjacent to what I know how to do, mm-hmm. or whether there are people, there are resources there or things that I can learn from. That to me is, you know, I feel like at this point more engaged in my career than I have in a long time. You know, I'm 50. I feel like this is almost like 2.0, the second act of like, I feel really fired up by taking this approach of engagement, which I think, you know, at some points in my early 40s, I was like, I'm just turning the wheel. I don't feel that now. So by purposely doing this kind of practice, I feel so much more engaged with really almost literally every day of the job that I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so cool. I had also wanted to ask you about your own kind of creative practice. Like, do you do any writing for yourself these days? Do you journal? Do you do anything that is creative and just for fun? What does that look like?
I'm ashamed to say that I don't. And it's funny because, you know, my bachelor's degree was in fine arts. It was drawing and painting and I could actually pinpoint the exact moment in art school. It was 1994 that like the tap turned off. I took an art criticism class and that killed it for me for the rest of eternity. I mean, I should never say never, right? But like all of a sudden, I suddenly absorbed the idea of like, oh, There, someone thinks that there are things in art that are good and not good. And the way they're explaining it, I don't know the difference. And that's a terrifying thought, right? And so it freaked me out so much. It just completely constrained my creative process in that domain. I just stopped doing it because all I could think of was, is this good? Is this not good? I don't even know if it's good or not good. And this is a very immobilizing thing for people. If there's an objective standard, like you have to run this far, this fast, you can just be like, okay, I'll just work on the skills and I'll work my way towards that objective standard, right? But in creative work, it's like, is this good? Is this not? Is this right or better? Is it, you know what I mean? Like it's a bit harder to pin down. And so if you're a creative person, that can send you down this weird vortex of like, is this any good? I don't know. I don't like, you know, and so it can take you out of the more, flow of just creating. So I've tried to resuscitate it a little bit. It's come back occasionally, but for me right now, the greatest area of play is with language. And, you know, definitely learning another language has created a lot of opportunities for play with it, right? And so I have a friend who speaks Russian fluently. And so, you know, as I learn the language and understand the rules of it, I play with, okay, what's an idiomatic expression in English that I would translate badly and literally to Russian, but then also like keep putting twists on it that play with the rules of the language so that if we're both native speakers, we can understand it, but it's so far from its original construction, it's unintelligible if you didn't have that ability. So, you know, I do find that there are still ways to play. Expressing my ideas at work is very playful because it's largely visual. Like I joke that my job is just making collages. So a lot of my job is making nice digital collages about ideas, about product flows, about where do we go app screen to app screen to app screen, but what is the concept that underlies it, right? So that is actually kind of fun. Part of my job in strategic thinking is making collages and thinking about visual communication. And that's a creative practice too. How do I get people to understand this crazy idea that I'm having? How do I communicate it in a way that's compelling and attractive and immediately understandable by someone who doesn't have a background in this? So that is the game that I enjoy playing. That's in a way become my creative practice.
Yeah. That's cool. That's an interesting story too about the your time in art school. I feel like for a lot of people, that's what happened with writing. And I try to help them bring some of that back if they're working with me one-on-one or just through the kind of encouragement and teaching that I try to put out into the world. Because I think for a lot of folks, they had that moment. Maybe it was in high school, maybe younger, maybe later, but where it was, you know, a teacher told them that they were bad at this, or they got bad grades, or they struggled to express themselves and get the ideas across effectively, or they just didn't really even have an opportunity to do that before it was shut down. And then feels like, okay, well, I can't do this, or I'm not good at it. And the battle is more around like actually being able to find that space to play so that it's not shut down before you even begin. You know, you just have like kind of the curse of that blank page, that it feels big and scary as opposed to something that you can play with.
Yeah. It's, I think for all creative people at some point in their life run into this, right? It's the editor brain versus the creator brain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I head up the copy team at my work, and I've, you know, worked a lot with junior writers, and I see them grinding those gears because the editing brain is kicking in immediately. You know, they put down one word and they're like, was that a good word? Right. And then it just stops them in their tracks. And so we talk a lot about not engaging the editor brain too soon. Just the creator brain has to come first. Just barf it up. Right. And I think for a lot of creatives, that is just a very common problem. The highly detail oriented part of your brain cannot be in the driver's seat. You know, you can bring it in later to look for spelling mistakes and formatting and all that kind of stuff, right? But there has to be a part of your brain that is more connected to your soul and that just flows and makes things without regard to, is this good? Is this not good? Does this even make sense? So, you know, ideally we can find spaces where it is okay to play. Like for me, it's Russian because I don't speak Russian. You know what I mean? Like no one expects me to be fluent. There's zero expectation. I can screw it up. And because I'm speaking to someone who's a native English or native speaker, you know, they can get what I'm saying. Even like, and it's actually quite remarkable learning languages. You know, I'm working with people for whom English is a second language, maybe even a third language. I can understand them remarkably well, even though what they're giving me in terms of syntax and grammar and pronunciation is way off the mark. I think that's quite fascinating. So, you know, for me, saying gibberish Russian to someone who speaks it is a space of play because it's of no consequence. Mm-hmm. So I have a friend who was struggling with a little bit of writer's block. I was like, look, here's your assignment. I want you to create 30 days of inconsequential opinions and put it on the internet. Because they were struggling with like, oh, I don't want to put it out there. Like, what if it's not good? I'm like, okay, come up with 30 days of stupid ideas, right? We had this debate, like, what is the best shape of a mug? And I actually disagreed very strongly with his choices. I will tell you, I felt his mug choices were incorrect. But anyway, you know, like, come up with stupid opinions, write about those. So find whatever your creative discipline is, find something that feels like a space of play, whether it's you write in crayon, you write with stickers, you write with that glitter pen, you write on one of those big sheets of, you get an Amazon package and it's wrapped in brown paper and you write on that brown paper, you know, like find a place that feels stupid, silly, playful, absolutely inconsequential, and use that as your playground to help kind of crack that worry about, is this good enough? Is this good enough?
Yeah, I love that. What a great practice. That's a great idea. Like, just to have places where you can completely take the weight of it that you might be feeling and the seriousness of it right off of the table.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We've got to wrap up, but this, I've just, before we go, I'm going to throw this question at you, and it's not even totally formed, but I'm just curious as to how you'll respond to it. It being completely different than the, like, just make a story out of stickers. It's maybe like a big question, but like, sometimes I use this word around our work, our sense of our body of work, of what we're building towards, and its legacy. It's sort of the idea that, you know, what you want to leave behind, or the broader impact that you want to make with your work. Is that something that you think about at all, of like what you want that to be, what you want to leave behind through your work, your writing, your coaching, like the kind of impact that you want to have? Or does that just not resonate? Like, I'm just curious as a concept of how you might respond to that.
Yeah, I have multiple feelings about legacy. One is, nothing I do matters. I'm just a pile of carbon atoms. And once I die, those carbon atoms will get repurposed into something else, maybe better, I don't know. And so I hold my existence very lightly. So I don't have a concept of legacy in the sense that I think a lot of people think about it. Now, that said, does it bring me an immediate sense of contentment and satisfaction to know that there were levers that I pulled in the world that might have positive effects, like ripple effects? Yeah, that feels good. And especially in the field that I work in, there's the potential to literally save people's lives, right? If I can influence people's health and fitness behavior, you know, so many of the health issues that we experience right now are incredibly preventable and treatable, right? And it's not to sort of promise some kind of fake longevity or anything like that, or to say like, oh, if you get such and such a disease, it's your fault. But really, we like more than ever before in history, can improve the odds of our own survival so significantly, more than any previous generations could have. So if I can help you do that, whether that is your physical health, your psychological health, your sense of well-being, your sense of purpose in the world, if I can unstick you so that you're able to care for yourself better, go on to care for the other people in your life better, you know, if I can have effects that ripple outwards for me, I have a sense of contentment and satisfaction about that. So it's kind of like two minds about legacy. I think that a long-term legacy is a fantasy. And hey, if it's a good fantasy if you want to have it, right? But like, there's very little I'm going to do, and it's probably going to be negative. Like, if you think about the people that have had lasting impacts on the world, I guess that's not true. I think, you know, so much of the beautiful legacies are largely invisible. Like, if we think about things like the medications we have, the improvements in, I don't know, basic safety standards, like who was the person that, you know, invented some kind of civil engineering safety standard that now prevents our buildings from falling down? I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. But that person kind of invisibly made our lives better and safer. And I think that there's so many examples of that. And, you know, so that's the kind of legacy that I like to imagine, sort of the invisible the invisible ants in the ant farm, right? Ant doing their ant things and contributing in ways that are unseen, but incredibly not even appreciated, like they're underappreciated, but that just make our society so much better. That's the kind of legacy I'd be happy to leave. But am I tied to it? No, you know, I hope for the best. I'll throw it on the wall and hope that it sticks.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for kind of going down this path with me of just exploring different aspects of self-expression, of communication, of, you know, your own story and how you think about life and your work. It's been really lovely.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It was definitely a wonderful chat.
Thanks for listening to the Storytelling with Heart podcast. Want to turn your thoughts into leadership and your ideas into words that make a difference? Find me and discover more free resources at www.camilledeputter.com. While you're there, don't forget to subscribe to my email newsletter where I share stories, free tools, and other storytelling guidance. And never forget, your story matters.